So it is Wednesday, September 24th, and this is Jan Jaeger speaking with Fred Alvsas, and in his home. It is about 10:15 in the morning, and this is a project, or this is a recording, for the Sildovia Village Tribe In Our Own Words project. And Fred, I know we've talked with you a couple times before and gotten some great information. One thing that we don't have a lot of is your history with fishing. And we were wondering if you could talk with us a little bit about what it was like to be a commercial fisher here and what your year would look like, not only the fishing season itself, but throughout the year.
My commercial fishing?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I started fishing. The first time I went fishing, commercial fishing, I was 9 years old. And I went on a seine boat plunging. And I made $15, and that was more money than you knew what to do with. And, I did some seining and so forth. And then when I got married in 1953, or 51, I guess it was, I went up the inlet set netting. And I set netted for many years. And it was a different type of fishing in those days, in that we had linen nets. We didn't have nylon, we didn't have polypropylene ropes or nothing like that. So each year you had to rehang all the nets, and you had to treat your nets. We washed the nets with bluestone, which is a copper concentrate, to kill the bugs and so forth that were in the nets, and because the nets would wear out real fast, especially in Cook Inlet with the mud flats. If you left the nets in the mud flats in the hot sun, when the tide came in, and the nets, the cork line would float up and the nets would stay in the mud, and it tore up pretty easy. So you had to be real careful with your nets. But in turn, there was lots of fish. You know, we had lots of fish, but less money, very little money. If I remember right, we started fishing for red salmon at 30 cents a fish, which we thought was pretty good money in those days, but compared to today's prices, it's not very much. But the first year I fished up there, we had a very good season, a lot of red salmon, a lot of silver salmon, and very good king salmon fishing. I had over 2,000 kings. And I made enough money that first year to buy a house and pay cash for it and property. And I paid my oil bill for the winter and my grocery bill for the winter, and I had money left over, which was really unusual in those days. And I didn't know an awful lot about fishing, set netting, but I stayed with it. Of course, being young and so forth, it was easy. And we also fished 5.5 days a week. We didn't have the closures like we have today. And it was a matter of whoever could stand the time frame and stay up and keep fishing. And most of the fishermen that fished in my area would fish on Mondays and Tuesdays, and by Wednesdays they'd be down to one net. We were allowed to fish three nets, but most people would pull out two nets just to keep them in reserve for more fish. But fish were still in the water, still coming, but there was much less. If you could only get 100 fish a day, it was hardly worth it. So that they'd rather pull the nets out. The fisheries developed slowly because during those days in the territory, it was federal regulations and the law was made back in Washington, D.C., and there was no on-site operations like there is today with the fish and game. The fishery changed drastically when we had statehood. And, statehood, they stopped the fish traps. The fish traps were the major competitors for us. And they took the fish traps out, and the price of salmon started going up, which was really good for us. But it was in turn, it was more competitive amongst the fish buyers and the plants, and it brought a lot of new effort into the Cook Inlet and rest of Alaska, in that there was a lot of people that were fish trap fishermen now fishing gillnets and seining. And it got to where they had to close the fisheries drastically. We got now days we're down to fishing 2 12-hour periods, and sometimes we don't even get that. If the fish aren't getting in the river, they shut it down. And it's on-site management, which probably is a lot better, but it's really difficult to maintain a steady fishery income. And because no matter whether you fish or not, you still have the high expense, the cost of the gear and operations and so forth. As time went by, they developed the nylon fishing nets. I recall the first nylon net I bought. I was so happy because I could only afford one, but I bought it. But I knew I had a net I didn't have to worry about. It didn't take me long to find out that they didn't know how to tie the knots good, so the nylon net slipped, and the fish would hit the net, and if he kept pushing, he'd work his way through the net and stretch the meshes out of sight. And by the end of the season, I had a terrible-looking net. It didn't have any tears or any rot or nothing like that, but it had a lot of holes where the fish went right through the net. So it took a few years before they got the good knots in the nets, and then they were much easier to fish. And also, the old linen gear only lasted, at, if you were lucky, 2 years. But with the nylon nets, I've got some nets that are probably 20 years old, and they're still usable. But of course, I prefer to buy new nets when I can afford it. The ropes were much different in that we had cotton ropes for the cork lines and manila rope for the other ropes and anchor lines and so forth. And they didn't last long. Each year you had to buy a new rope. Now I've got ropes that's nylon and polypropylene, and it lasts forever, as long as you take care of it. So the fishery has evolved a lot through the years. And in turn, everything else has changed. The markets have changed. We used to fish all summer, and when the fish canneries, they canned all the fish. If they got too many fish, they'd stop buying. They'd let us know, and we had what was called a limit. And they'd say, well, today we can only take 500 fish. Well, sometimes you'd have maybe 1,000 fish, and they wouldn't take them, so you had to dump them. But there wasn't anything else you could do, and there was plenty of fish. But today's market is primarily frozen fish, and so they process, and the thing now is to get fresh fish. We used to put the fish on a barge, and they laid in the sun, and we covered them with burlap, but that didn't do much to keep them. And if the fish buyers, the tenders, didn't take the fish right away, they'd lay there and get soft. But it didn't matter that much because the fish was canned. But if you had to sell them fresh, frozen, or process them for freezer operations, it wouldn't have been worth saving. Nowadays, of course, as you catch the fish, you ice them, and the fish plants keep them cold and so forth, and you deliver right away. You deliver the same day. And sometimes when we fish for the old days, some of the fish would be 3 days old before they got to the canneries. And especially when the fish run was on, there was a tremendous amount of fish, and they just couldn't keep up. But so quality is much better today. And the fishermen are much better at taking care of the fish. They ice them, they bleed them, and so forth. And so it's a quality product, and a lot of that you can see in the marketing, like the Copper River Kings in the spring, the first kings caught, they fly them right away to Seattle and so forth to the market because they're highly valued. And we also fished with wooden boats, and we didn't have very good outboards. We had outboards. Most of the set netters used a 9-horse Johnson in those days, and they were okay, but they weren't really that dependable. There was lots of times they just wouldn't start. They just were hard operating outboard. Where today, with the new motors, you just push the button and away you go. And so it was a tougher way to fish, especially when the weather was rough. There's nothing worse than being out in a leaky wooden boat with an outboard that won't run. And I've had my share of experiences with that. I can recall I wasn't but, maybe 1,000 feet off the beach, and the waves were breaking, and my boat was leaking, and I couldn't get my outboard running, but I didn't dare pull my anchor. I was anchored to keep my boat from washing up on the rocks. And nowadays, you don't have that problem. We have the aluminum boats and good motors, and much safer. I've got a few friends that never quite made it through they washed overboard or whatever happened to them, and they were lost. But overall, the fishery is better in that the quality is better and so forth. The fish are worth more money nowadays. But in turn, there's much less fish and more competition for the fish and less time to catch the fish. Present day's fishing is mostly on Tuesdays and Thursdays or Mondays and Thursdays. And if you have a run of fish that comes through on the evening of the first day, then you have to wait several days. The whole run could be by before you even get a chance to fish again. So that makes it very difficult. But in turn, the competitions, there's so many more boats and so many more nets. If everybody was able to fish at once, they'd just wipe out the runs entirely. So I would say overall Fishing Game does a good job managing the fishery. You don't think so when you have to pull your nets up and there's still fish running, but after the season's over and you have a chance to think about it, it's a good fishery nowadays. So I don't know much about the seining operations, but I know through the years the boats have really drastically improved. Much, much better boats, much better gear, and more efficiency. But for the set net fishery, that's about it. So what else can I tell you?
What were kind of your tasks throughout the year for getting ready for fishing and in terms of hanging nets and repairing gear and so on?
Well, I hung my nets during the winter time mostly. When I first started fishing, it was a tradition. Everybody hung their nets for king salmon with the large mesh nets. We fished 8 1/4-inch mesh because we only wanted the big kings. And then in June month, after the king run was over, you had to strip all the corks and lead lines off the nets and rehang the red nets on the same lines. And by the second year I was fishing, I figured I was wasting my time. I could do other things. So I just bought more cork lines, more lead lines, and I hung the nets, and I didn't strip them till the nets wore out. The lines were cotton. The first floats we had were wooden floats. They were made out of cedar, very, very heavy. And by the end of the season, they soaked up a lot of water. So you had to be a pretty strong person to pack the cork line and lead line on a net. We'd pack them up and down the beach. And just every time we brought the nets in, we had to take them up, and I had a tank. We put them in with the bluestone and water to wash them and rinse them and dry them and mend them. And it was a constant process. And I decided that it was better to have more floats, more lead lines. And I know my neighbors, they thought I was foolish buying all that extra gear, but it saved a lot of time. And at that time, we started fishing. Everybody lived in tents, and I just raising my family and the kids and all. Tents on a rainy day are not very much fun. So I started building a house, and I just, from that time on, I've continued on and on. And there's a picture of my fish camp there, and you can see there's 40, 50 years of building there, and none of it was built in one day. And I built the houses while I was fishing, and it was quite a process. And now, of course, some of it's getting pretty old and needing repairs, but that's the way it goes. And it's a wonderful place, and this summer I managed to make a trip over, and I only spent a week. My grandson does the fishing now, and I I do the talking, and his job is repairing everything. The floats is kind of an interesting thing. I think the gillnet floats were first cedar floats, and they were waxed originally, but the wax wore off and they absorbed water. But then somebody came up with a new invention of aluminum floats. The aluminum floats were not very well built, and they tended to bust and leak, and they were worse than no floats when they had water in them. Then they came up with a plastic float, and it was a plastic float with a hole through it, and they were much, much better and much lighter, but they also start cracking. They would last a couple of years, and then they'd crack and leak, and so it was a constant headache with them. Nowadays we have foam floats, and the foam is coated, so it's not porous, and much lighter, much better, and you don't have to maintain them so much as we did the original floats, and an awful lot lighter than the old cedar floats. When I changed gear and got rid of all my wooden floats, I had 3 barrel drums full of floats, and my kids loved them for firewood, and now they're kind of like a collector's item, but they burned them all just for firewood, and they loved that cedar. The same is with the lead lines. The lead lines were cut in rope, where they poured lead on the line, and they would last a few years, but eventually the cotton would wear and the lines would start breaking. And now we have nylon lead lines with the lead inside the rope, and they last forever. They're great, much easier to maintain and so forth. But I lost a lot of lead lines through the years, just because where we fish, the tide is so strong, the lines would break and whatnot. I learned the hard way how to fish in strong tides, I know when I first started fishing, the people that fished in my area, they wouldn't put their nets out when the tide was running strong. And I felt that a lot of fish were going by, so I'd put my nets out anyway. And they'd break, they'd tear, and so forth. But I still caught fish. And I think that was the main thing. And now with the new gear, with the nylon nets and the poly ropes and so forth, you can fish through any of the strong tides. It doesn't matter. Now we kind of like the new ways. And we developed a system of tying the lead lines down and putting weights on the lead lines to keep to get the net deeper in the water. Fish were going by underneath the nets at first, and it didn't take long to figure out that we weren't catching as many fish as we thought we should. And the first years, when we had a lot of fish, it really didn't matter. We were catching as many as we could handle. But nowadays, you really have to work for every fish, and it makes a big difference. And the person that takes care of the nets and sets the nets and so forth will catch fish. So a lot of people I know through the years that would set their nets and they'd go home and they'd go have a, go hiking or picnicking or whatever. And the seagulls were eating the fish out of their nets, and the nets would go dry with fish in them, and the seagulls would eat on them. And they just didn't seem to care. And I never thought that was a good way to fish. It was poor quality fish delivered, and a lot of fish lost to the seals. And we had, back in the early 50s, hundreds if not thousands of seals. And they were, as soon as you set a net, they were right there looking for a free meal. And nowadays, the seals are down, the numbers are down, and we still have a problem with the seals, but not so many. There's, I would guess we probably have 4 or 5 seals a day come by checking their nets, where before we had hundreds. And I sure don't miss them. We also had a tremendous amount of belugas, especially during the king salmon season. But belugas never bothered the nets. They would swim between the nets and around the nets, but they never bothered the nets. They wouldn't take fish out of the nets. And in turn, I always felt that when the beluga showed up, it was good fishing because the fish would move in on the beach more and the belugas would be chasing them on the outside, a half mile or so offshore. And that brought the kings in closer to the beach, and I always thought it was much better. And so we didn't bother the belugas, but we shot at the seals and killed as many as we could. But it was a constant problem. I had a running battle with one particular seal for about 5 or 6 years. And finally I got him. And when we skinned him out, he was just festered with 22 bullets and shotgun slugs and all kinds of shots. And from his chest up, his head was all festered and so forth. And we eventually threw him away. I showed my neighbors what it looked like, and the hide was terrible, so we threw it all away. But he was one tough seal to get. I would shoot at him, and he'd still get away. And but I finally got him, and I'm sure there was others like that, but that one in particular, I'll never forget him. And he was a big, big seal. And we had a few sea lions at times. The problem with sea lions was they would get in and tear the net. They'd get in the net and roll around or whatever. And they never really got stuck, but they could tear tremendous big holes in the net. Where seals, they just wanted to grab the fish out. But it's a running battle, and if you're going to be a commercial fisherman, you have to be with those nets all the time. Otherwise, somebody else will get their fish. Now, with less fish, less seals, more effort, but a much better quality of fish. I think fish are good when they're fresh, but they're not worth very much when you just let them lay in the sun. And I just don't like to see that happen. And I know some people catch fish and they just don't know what to do with the fish when they catch them. But it's important to take care of your fish as good as possible.
You had talked about fish traps a little bit. Were there fish traps right around Saldovia, pre-statehood?
We had a fish trap right outside Saldovia on the far end of Hone Spit. In the summertime, my family would move from town over to Hone Spit because we had large gardens there, and we had a cow and a bull, and the fish trap was right outside. And Fred Hone, who Hone Spit is named for, he lived on the spit, and he was also the watchman on the trap, fish trap. And it was a pile trap. They drove the piling, and they drove offshore. And we got king salmon from the trap, because in those days, the fish canneries didn't have machinery geared up for canning king salmon. They were primarily for smaller fish, the reds, silvers, humpies, and dog salmon. But my dad had a fish trap for 30 years up where the oil docks are now in off of Kenai. And they were pile traps too. And he was also a pile driver operator, and he drove the pile in and then fished the trap and then pulled the pile in the fall. But the trap out of Saldovia was very efficient. There was a trap on McDonald Spit at Nubble Point. There was a trap over on the Homer side in Catchmack on just past Bluff Point. I can't remember the name of the creek there, but it's just past Bluff Point. And there was one down on Flat Island, inside of Flat Island. And that was one, two. That was only four traps in the Catchmack area. But they were very efficient. As a matter of fact, when the fish traps were catching good fishing, the canneries wouldn't buy from the fishermen. That was another major problem with the fish traps were so efficient. They catch fish all the time. And then when the fish trap is closed, like for Saturday and Sunday, the fish would lay against the lead, that long lead of piling that came off the beach, and there was a fair buildup of fish. So whenever they opened the trap, the fish would swim along the lead out trying to get around the trap, but they would funnel into a holding pen made out of web, which was called a pot. And the pot of the trap would hold the fish. And then adjacent to that, there was a tunnel that went into what was called a spiller. And the fish went into the spiller, and from there, the fish tenders, boats would come, and they'd tie up to this trap and take this large net system they had and dip down and scoop the fish out of the spiller onto the boat. The spiller was a little smaller than the pot, because the pot could hold thousands and thousands of fish. And I recall one day my dad's trap, they railed 26,000 fish in one tide. And that was just unheard of for any gillnet fisherman to catch. But they figured that was a pretty good day. The traps were very efficient, and they were built out. They had a series of piling built so that if the fish tried swimming along the lead, if they didn't go into the pot, they might try to swim around the trap, and they would go into the heart of the trap, which was a series of piling and web and wire, and they would their heart was designed just like a heart, both sides of the trap, and it would turn the fish back toward the lead, and the fish would eventually wind up in the pot. But I recall standing up on top of the trap watching the fish, and you could see the fish as they come along the lead. You can see them in the water, and they'll get to the tunnel that goes into the pot, and they hesitate. But eventually more fish show up, and pretty soon they all go through. And I never seen any fish ever turn around and go back the way they came in. They just seem to trying to get around the trap or get away from the wire, and in turn it led them right into the pot, and they were caught. So it was very efficient. They were so efficient, they put a lot of fishermen out of work. But in turn, they were also owned by the big companies. The large fish companies owned the traps. There was only, I only know of two traps that were owned by individuals. And they were limited to what they could deliver depending on what the company traps owned. And so I think statehood was a good thing in that they got rid of the fish traps. And it was a very popular vote at the time to get rid of that competition. If the traps were owned by individuals, it probably would have been a different situation. But since they were company-owned by the large fish packers, the vote was to vote out the fish traps. I know today you hear a lot of talk, especially amongst the politicians, about having home rule and making our own decisions and so forth and so forth. That's somewhat true, but the fish trap issue was the real reason we voted for statehood.
And I've heard before that those issues were tied together. Was it understood, or I guess I should say, was it a separate vote? People voted for statehood, and then there was a second vote once statehood had been achieved to vote out the fish traps, or were they tied together in the same vote?
It was all in one vote. Yeah. Yeah. If we have statehood, we'll get rid of the traps. And, yeah, when the vote was taken, that was the end of fish traps. But even my dad voted for statehood, even though he was a trap fisherman all his life. You know, 30 years of fishing for fish traps, he knew something had to be done. But it was just so efficient. And if you look at this, just on Salamat Beach, which is the beach from Kenai River north up to East Foreland, there was 10 fish traps. They're a mile apart. And they were so efficient. You know, when those fish, the Kenai River red salmon hit that beach, and then on Kalifonsky Beach, between the Kenai River and Kasilif River, there was 10 more traps. You know, those traps there could catch more fish than all the commercial fishermen put together would ever catch. And once they start loading up with fish, the commercial fishing, the buyers, the canneries would not buy from the fishermen. As a matter of fact, several of the fishermen in that area used to go in and work in the cannery when the fish run hit because they couldn't fish. As soon as the traps start getting less fish, the run was over, the fishermen could go back on the beach and fish again. But everything was run by the big canned salmon industry. And that's a great thing to see that monopoly busted. We were very happy with that. Now, I fished for a cannery out of Anchorage, and they didn't have fish traps, so they bought from setting at fishermen all along the beaches. But they were also limited by how many fishermen they could handle. When you have an abundance of fish, it's difficult to find somebody willing to buy your fish all summer. But I managed to fish for the cannery in Anchorage, and it worked very well.
So did you have to deliver in Anchorage then?
No, I had a barge, and I anchored my barge off the beach, and their fish tenders would come and take the fish off the barge. So it was very, very easy for me. And I had some other fishermen in the area put their fish on my barge also. But nowadays, there's no tenders, and there's no barges, and so forth. So we have to bring our fish into Kenai to sell them, which is an added hazard and so forth. But each fish day, you run your fish into Kenai. And if you get good fishing, you got to make two trips. And we can haul, 1,500 fish or so in. And because now as we catch the fish, we also ice them. And when we go to, when we deliver the fish, we get ice from the plant and take it back for icing the next fish. So it's far, far different, but the fish quality is much, much better.
Our recorder's back on now. Still September 24th with Fred Alvsas and Jan Yeager, and it is now 11:10 in the morning, and we're still talking with Fred. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more. We mentioned statehood and how the fish traps were taken out at statehood. Can you talk a little bit more about the other changes that you saw around the time of statehood?
Well, you know, talking about the Solovia area, there's a tremendous amount of changes. Alaska is a boom and bust state. But, you know, first thing was the furs. Of course, there was the sea otters and the local fur and the trapping. And then they had the herring fishery. Kachemak Bay was a great herring fishery. And there was herring saltries all over the place. Solovia, there were several saltries right in town, as well as those along Kachemak Bay and Halibut Cove. And after the herring was gone, there was the fur farming, the fox farming. There were several fox farms around Solovia and Kachemak Bay. So, see, they'd have the big burst of product or energy, the fur, the herring, the foxes, but then there'd be the bust. And then there was the salmon. The salmon started, and the first salmon fishing was done for salting also. And then eventually they started canning the salmon. And the salmon industry lasted the longest of all the efforts in Solovia. They brought fish from Cook Inlet and Kodiak, even in Copper River. I fished over there prior to statehood and area registration. You could fish wherever you wanted. I fished in Copper River 1 year, and then we fished in Cook Inlet for a while, and then we went to Kodiak and fished, and then back to Cook Inlet, and it was just, you fished in Alaska. But then, after the salmon, then we had the king crab industry, and king crab, there was just practically no end to the king crab. I never thought we'd ever see a king crab fishery closed, and it was one of the more enjoyable fisheries. All during the salmon and crab fishing, we also had the halibut fishery. So we had a cold storage here. And so Silovia was a very busy, busy place. The fish plants were working. We had the salmon canneries. We had the cold storage for the halibut. And we had a reduction plant here that took care of all the fish waste. And then we started the crab fishery. And about the time of the earthquake and so forth, that was the end of the salmon canneries here in Silovia. And the crab fishing kept on, and it was very good. But, and I recall I had a couple of crab boats, and the biologist at that time was telling us that we should have more in the way of conservation and so forth, and we couldn't understand why. There were so many crab, no matter where you put your crab pots, you had crab. And little by little, it got worse and worse, and the fishery moved to Kodiak and further west, and pretty soon they had to shut down the king crab fishing. And then we had the Tanner crab fishery. And there was... plant operator asked me one time if I would, after king crab fishing was over for the season, if I would go out and bring in some tanner crab. They wanted to try processing them. They didn't know exactly how to handle them. So he said, what would you want? And I said, well, I'll tell you what. We want $200. I'll take one man, and we'll go and put 10 pots out, and we'll fish them for $200, and you give us the bait. So he said, okay, and we went. We loaded the boat. We filled the boat full in 9 pots. The last pot, we couldn't pull it. We just had too many crab. We came into the plant, and the plant operator came out on the dock, and he looked down. He said, all I wanted was a couple of hundred. I said, well, we rebaited the pots and set them back. And so they took the crab, and so they couldn't process that many crab. There was no way they were set up for it. And there was more of an experimental thing. And the next day we went out, and there wasn't that many crab in the pot. The king crab pot web, the tanner crab could crawl right back out again. Once they found out they couldn't get the bait, they left the pots. So it wasn't that bad the second day, but that first day, we were very happy, just loading, dumping the crab in the fish hole, and at least they're going to be happy with the fish. Then they didn't want that many. They never told us to only bring a couple hundred in. So we started the tanner crab fishing, and that's the way it was. If we didn't load up every day, we were not very happy fishermen. And of course, the effort got tremendous effort, all the boats fishing from Saldovia and Homer, And the same thing happened as to the king crab. They had to shut it down, and now it's difficult to find them. Although I know you can find them. You have to know where to look. The last crab opening that I fished was a special opening. I can't remember what the limit was on it, but it wasn't going to last long. But I set 50 pots out, and the index showed that the Tanner crab are mostly around Homer Spit, but there was like close to 100 boats registered to fish. And I figured they're all going to fish up there where the index showed the crab. There's going to be so many boats, their lines are going to tangle and everything. So I loaded my gear, and I sat right outside of Soldovia. And I said, I'm not going to go up there and get in that mess with the other boats. And we did very well. My crew wasn't happy. They were, like everybody, they knew what the index showed. But with all those boats fishing up there, they were getting like 20 and 30 crab per pot. And we set. Our first pot had 80-some crab, but I'll never forget the second pot was 126 crab, keeper crab, and all nice, beautiful brown crab. And they all figured I knew something. I didn't know anything. I just wasn't going to tangle up with all those other pots. And we had a very good fishery out of it, and we delivered. We tied up in the boat harbor for the night and then went back the next day. And it was a three-day fishery, and the limit was, that was the end of the fishery. And we did very well on that fishery. But by the evening of the second day, you could see those boats bringing pots down the bay. They're hauling their gear. They're getting out of there. There was no more crab up there. I felt pretty good about that. But to truth be known, I didn't have a clue where the crab were. But we lucked out. So that's, you know, then we also had the logging operation in Jackloff Bay, which brought a lot of people to Soldovia. And they did very well. But again, every one of these things, the fur, the herring, the fox farms, the salmon fishery, the crab fishery, it all crashed. And now you see Soldovia is a very quiet little community, more retired people.